All right, good evening. My name is Alex Hecht, and I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. It's really great to see so many faces, and I'm really very excited to speak about this complex topic. So first, I'd like to thank our partners in this event, the Bayit and Shari Shamayim, for partnering with us in this program, and especially with much appreciation to Rabbi Karapkin and Rabbi Strauchler, not only supporting, but also participating in the program, as many of you saw the other night. And we look forward to our continued learning and teaching together. So all through this week, we're discussing different facets of, call it Jewish identity, which is a very broad topic. It means, you know, sometimes can mean different things to different people. And in the fascinating panel discussion that we had on Sunday night with Rabbi Strauchler and Rabbi Karapkin, so it mostly focused on the very important question of how do we foster Jewish unity? How do we relate to Jews whose ideas and practices are different from us? And you know, what do we do in general to create an environment of unity, an environment of peace? But tonight, I'd like to focus on really the what. What is it that unifies the Jewish people? And if there's any setting where you can see that there's seemingly no, or definitely no uniform ideology, political views among the Jewish people, is, I'm not sure if anyone's ever been to the Israeli Day Parade in New York. But for me, I've been several times, and in the parade, you always see, one, that the marchers come from several different schools of different denominations in the New York area. But then on the sides, you have, you know, the Neturei Karta, the religious anti-Zionists, you have on the other side, you have the Jewish Voices for Peace, more of a secular anti-Israel group, but that's, you know, it's purportedly Jewish. And then another part of the parade, you have on the side the Jewish Defense League, and you really have see there, it gives you a picture that, you know, certainly politically and religiously there's no uniform ideology, you know, that brings all Jews together. So the question is, what is it that that unites the Jewish people? So I want to discuss three groups, at least on a spectrum of Jewish belief, practice, and culture. And that's Satmar to settler to secular. So what are these three groups? Just to give a little bit of background. So group number one is Satmar. So the Satmar Hasidic group, it's, I think, considered the largest Hasidic group in the world. They originated in Hungary, and they established themselves in North America and in communities around the world, mainly by Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum. He came first he was in Israel, but he came to the United States after the Second World War, and he really built up and reestablished the Hasidic community that he had in Europe. And one of the main characteristics of their ideology is that they believe that it's forbidden to establish a Jewish government in Israel before the arrival of Mashiach. We'll explain a little bit more what's the basis for that ideology. So that's one. Religious Jews, Torah observant Jews, but who believe that it was forbidden to establish a state of Israel. And as a result, they actually don't participate in elections. They don't vote. They don't take money from the government, basically view the enterprise as illegitimate. Although there are a substantial number of Satmar Hasidim and other Orthodox anti-Zionist groups who do in fact live in the land of Israel. We'll also see a little bit why that could be. The next group are the settlers. So we refer to settlers, mainly have in mind the those who consider themselves the students of Avraham Yitzhak Cook, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, but in particular were followers of his son, Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who after Israel's victory in the Six-Day War, understood, or even before that, they understood the establishment of the State of Israel as a step in the messianic process, in the process of final redemption. In particular, after the miraculous victories in the Six-Day War, so Tzvi Yehuda Cook and those who followed in his ideology felt that it was very important to settle in as much of the land of Israel as possible. And in general, those who are part of quote unquote the settlers, sometimes it's used in a derogatory sense, and I certainly don't mean to use it in that sense, but tend to be, as a result, opposed to land concessions. And some will even, will certainly settle and live in places that are, they pass the green line, which is the subject of international contention. But also, there are even some, because more on the fringes, but will even settle in places that the State of Israel doesn't officially allow them to settle in. But that's the ideology that really the opposite of Satmar. Satmar says they're religious Jews, but they say that it's forbidden to establish a Jewish government in Israel before the coming of Mashiach. The settlers, the religious Zionists, say that it's a, not only is that forbidden, but it's a positive step in the messianic process and the final redemption to establish a Jewish government and a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. And then the third group is secular. So the way secular can refer to a very broad range of people and practices and ideas, and sometimes it means different things to different people, but what I have in mind when discussing secular is Jews for whom religion is not a major part of their Jewish identity. I'm not really going to touch upon non-Orthodox movements. We heard about that the other night, but just in general, Jews who do not define themselves and consequently generally don't practice according to religious Judaism and Jewish law. So, and obviously there are many more groups within Klal Yisrael, within the Jewish people, and I picked these three, one, because it made for a catchy title, and two, because there's stark ideological, cultural, and behavioral differences between these groups. So Shir will address these groups, but we'll also touch upon other groups as well. And also, just to find what we're speaking about with the Jew, I understand there may be others who will define it differently, but the definition and criteria that we're going to be working with is assuming that someone who's born to a Jewish mother or has undergone a halakhic conversion. So now to the survey. I'm not sure how many people here took the survey, but I was actually surprised that one, the amount of responses I got, which was, there are 18 responses last I checked. There's about 17 more than I expected, because I bet I was the first one to take it. Just looked like someone did it. But it was actually, and I was pleasantly surprised, the responses were more diverse, both by the people who took it, how they identified within the Jewish community, but also the responses were definitely not monolithic. And even among those who shared the same self-definition or the same identification with the community, that there was definitely a variety of responses, and I found it very interesting. So I'll just share briefly, just go down the main results of the survey. So here is this. Wow, we just got another 20 responses. And actually, the last couple of responses kind of changed my theories about it. I haven't done an official study. But as far as who took, can everyone see the screen? So as far as who took the survey, so the majority identified as modern Orthodox, and I'm not surprised by that, because that's, you know, that makes up a large part of the shuls that we're involved with. 20% was conservative, and 10% was, I don't believe in labels. Is that that percentage actually shrunk? At first, there was percentage wise there were more, but that was basically the breakdown of it. So then, when you go to the question, what's the strongest unifier of the Jewish people? So the majority said religion, and not so surprisingly, the majority of those who said religion generally identified as modern Orthodox. You had second to that history, common. Now it's a tie, as it is now, a common historical background, historical experiences, and then you had culture and national identity. But the two questions I was particularly interested in seeing was the following two questions. There's one I have most in common with a Jew who shares my perspective on the choices were Israel, Jewish law, political candidates, and social issues. But then there's, I feel least comfortable around Jews with whom I disagree with those same options. And I noticed that in particular when looking at particular responses, particular groups that people identified with a focus on the on modern Orthodox in particular, just because those were the majority of the respondents, is it's not entirely the same. This is 40% say the Jewish law is what they have in common with other Jews who share their perspective on that. And the vast majority of those who identified as modern Orthodox picked this option. But when it came to Jews who I feel least comfortable about, around, it wasn't such a big jump, but it was less. Many of those who picked Jewish law as the factor that they had most in common, it was not necessarily what they responded for, what they had for the Jews with whom they feel least comfortable about, if they have disagreements. Then there became more bounce towards Israel, and actually there was a fairly large amount who picked social issues and even political candidates. And in recent current events, it's not so surprising. And then the last question, which I want to address towards the end, is the question: we're obligated to love every Jew. And the majority said yes. There was a significant minority who said no, and that's a real question. What's the what are the limits of loving other Jews? So that was a survey. So now to get to the different groups. So I'm going to copy the link to the source sheet in the shiur, but people would prefer that I also share the screen. I'll do that as well. Okay. So now if we're discussing what unifies the Jewish people, so we are going to connect the different parts. We have Satmar to secular, and Satmar to settler, and then settler to secular. So first going from Satmar to settler, and in many ways, although their views on the modern state of Israel are very different from a religious perspective, it was fairly simple to identify what these groups had in common. And what these groups have in common is a belief, and the foundation of everything they do and the foundation of how they see everything is that they believe that the Torah was given from Hashem to the Jewish people, and they accept the Torah, they accept its laws, and you know, for the most part, have the same basic process and mechanisms for deciding Jewish law, for interpreting it. They have, you know, from the Torah, from the written Torah, from the oral Torah, meaning the Mishnah and the Talmud, and then all the way through the codes of the various Jewish law codes, including the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, and you know, probably I would even say 99% of issues, but if not, you know, certainly 90% of different questions of Jewish law, the answers will be, you know, pretty similar. Or if they're different, they're not necessarily different based on their ideological differences. And you know, and this commitment to observing the Torah and keeping its laws is found in the Torah's account of the giving of the Torah. The Torah says Hashem tells Moshe to tell the people that in source one, attempt to Ulim Amlechas Koyanim V'Goy Kadosh, you will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And Moshe tells the people, it is Vaynu Kol Ha'am Yachda V'Yomer Kol Asher Diber Hashem Naseh. And the people said, whatever Hashem has said, we will do. And that's the basic commitment. The oftentimes said is Naseh V'Nishma, we'll do and we'll hear, as mentioned elsewhere, but that perspective, that we believe that the Torah was given on Mount Sinai to the Jewish people, and we accept to follow its laws as is written in the Torah and how it's interpreted throughout the generations by its halachic authorities. So at the core, I think it's pretty simple to identify what unifies, let's say, the Satmar and the secular. And I think that this factor that unifies them is very, very important, very fundamental. By the way, if anyone has anything to say or disagrees with anything that I'm saying, you know, please feel free to respond. You know, these are just my perspectives, though, you know, everyone will have their own perspective about this. So at any point, please feel free to share your perspective. So while I said that the factor that unifies, let's say, the Satmar and the secular is fairly straightforward and, you know, very, very fundamental, and on, you know, most questions of Jewish law, the differences in ideology won't necessarily impact the halakhic rulings, the legal rulings. Nevertheless, there are read several articles, and actually spoken about this with my colleague and Chavrusa, Nathaniel Klein, as part of our Beit Midrash, and he said, and it's something that I think is well established, that if you were to ask people in the religious Zionist community, we said settlers, but in the broader community that certainly believes in the establishment of the state of Israel, but believes that it has, you know, positive religious significance, many, and you were to ask them, do you feel closer to the Haredim, or not only Satmar, but call it the ultra-Orthodox, groups who are the anti-Zionists, or some who are, you know, non-Zionists, but generally, you know, with notable exceptions, but generally, you know, don't go to the army, and don't think that the state of Israel has its religious significance. Do you feel closer or have more in common with them, with the Haredim, or with the Chilonim, with, we'll call it the secular, Israelis who are non-halachically observant? And apparently many, and then Michael Bruce said that he would think that the vast majority, not all, but the vast majority, will actually say that they feel closer with or have more in common with the secular Jew. And Tadal said that a large part of that is the issue around the army. One, the tension that inevitably exists with serving in the army, for those who serve in the army and those who don't, it was interested. I actually gave this a version of the shiur twice about serving in the army. It's it's a complex topic that certainly practice is very heated. So there's the question of serving in the army, one, because the sense of shared experience, shared obligation, and at least the feeling that others are shirking their obligation, but also just socially, that it's common to ask, what did you do in the army? Just like you say, what university did you go to? What what yeshiva did you go to? The army is something that brings people together and is a point of common experience, and therefore many members of the broader religious Zionist community may say that they identify more with or have more in common with the secular community than with the Haredi community. There's a comment in the chat that's surprising to me, right? No, see, that's comment says surprising to me is I think their common belief in Torah observance would be more important than issues of army participation. So I'll tell you the truth. I would think so too. At the same time, I've never lived in Israel on a long-term basis. I haven't served in the army, so I can't usually speak to those experiences, but that would be the way that I feel. And that has been the, that sentiment, or that perspective has been expressed by major figures within the religious Zionist world. And I'll focus on two. One, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who is the founder of Yeshivat Har Etzion, and Shlomo Aviner, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat HaTeret Kohanim in the Old City. And both of them speak very strongly, and I think it's very clear that it's in response to this this attitude that exists perhaps among their students, that without a doubt, the common belief in the divinity of the Torah and in the binding nature of halacha and in halachic practice is a much stronger, or should be a much stronger unifier than even other considerations like the army. And Rav Lichtenstein says in source number two, because when all is said and done, we should recognize and realize that what we share with the rightist community, really referring to the Haredi or quote-unquote ultra-Orthodox community, far outweighs whatever divides us. Although in the nature of things, the focus within the community is upon the divisive element. Sometimes have the feeling that with regard to perceiving that community, we're often somewhat remiss. And he quotes he says a religious professor in Jerusalem. I think he's referring to Professor David Weiss Halivni, who is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary, the Conservative Seminary, and then they established the Union for Traditional Judaism. And I think he said the following, that the people I can talk to, I can't daven with, and the people I daven with, I can't talk to. Meaning sometimes you have more in common with those whose religious beliefs are different than yours, but who share other beliefs. But Rav Lichtenstein says that for B'nai Torah, of course, the shared universe of Talmudic discourse, of Havos, the Abaye v'Rava, the disputes between the Talmudic sages Abaye and Rava, serves as a great cementing force. And he addresses the question about, for example, the army. He says, for even amongst B'nai Torah, many in our camp no doubt find it easier to talk, perhaps even to work, with an intelligent secular colleague than with our Karliner Chassid, forgetting that the pleasantries attendant upon passing the time of day cannot compare with the shared vision of eternity. I mean, he's saying maybe socially there's, might be more to talk about with someone who's secular, but their life, their general worldview is without a doubt more similar, not only more similar, but essentially shared with the quote-unquote ultra-Orthodox. And he says that this shouldn't be, can hardly be overemphasized. That, and he says factors like Malchut Shemayim and Avodat Hashem, accepting the sovereignty of heaven and service of God, is something that's fundamental to both the religious Zionist, the settlers, as we're calling it here, and the ultra-Orthodox, and that will, without a doubt, should without a doubt be a stronger unifier than anything else. But he says, and I think this is important to recognize, important differences clearly do exist, and those relate to substance as well as to style, to strategy no less than to tactics, right? And then we saw one example of that is the perspective on the state of Israel. But he says that it's very clear, and he's clearly responding to the attitude that maybe religious Zionists have more in common with the Chilonim, the secular population of Israel, by their perspective on Zionism. But Revlechtenstein is saying the Zionism of the religious Zionist world is sourced in the belief of the divinity of the Torah and the fact that halacha, Jewish law, is binding. And that basic belief and foundation is something that's shared with the Haredim and is not shared with the Chilonim. So the next two sources, Rav Shlomo Aviner is one of the major figures in the religious Zionist world. As you can say, he's not a quote unquote settler per se. He lives in Jerusalem. He happens to have the yeshiva in the Arab quarter of the Old City, and he was a student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, who believed in settling the entire land of Israel. And he had a post, I think it was written, it was a talk that he gave in the yeshiva, it called We Love Satmar Hasidim. And when this was posted a couple of years ago, it was widely shared, because you have one of the major figures in the religious Zionist world making this powerful statement about a group that's perhaps the most anti-Zionist in the religious world. And I think at this point, just to give a background of the Satmar position, it's not exclusive to Satmar, but the premise of the position is a passage in the Talmud in Sechik Tubot that describes three oaths that the Jewish people and one that the nations of the world took when the Jewish people went into exile. One oath that, there were two oaths that the Jewish people took. One was not to go up like a wall, not to emigrate to Israel en masse. Meaning individuals could, but something like a mass aliyah, seemingly according to that passage in the Talmud, would be problematic based on this oath. Oath number two is that the Jewish people not rebel against nations of the world. So not go and take parts of the land of Israel by force. And the oath number three, which was administered to the nations of the world, was not to oppress the Jewish people excessively. You know, that I'm not sure historically if that worked out, if they kept their side of the bargain. And the Talmud says that if the Jewish people violate this oath, so they'll be harmed. But there's a question in general, how this passage in the Talmud is meant to be understood. It's not quoted by any of the major halakhic authorities, going from the Rishonim, the early authorities, the Rush, the Rif. It's not quoted by the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch. It's not really mentioned in any of the halakhic sources. The Satmar Rebbe, in his book Vayol Moshe, which we'll see part of it, has responses to that. It's not so simple, but that's the basis of the belief that the Jewish people are not allowed to establish a self-government in Israel until the coming of Mashiach. And the basic premise of that is that we were sent into exile, and until Hashem takes us out of exile, it's not our place to speed things up. So that's the basis. But you see, it's based on some on a passage in the Talmud. There could be different interpretations, but again, they're going back to the same sources. Just like religious Zionists would look to the Talmud if they wanted to determine a halakhic or even philosophical issue. So in Rav Aviner's piece, We Love Satmar Chassidim, so he basically says that we have the same goals, but different means. And he says, which I think is important to recognize. He says, we love Satmar Chassidim because our disagreement with them is about the means, not the goal. There is no essential difference, similar to what Rav Lichtenstein was saying, between our goals and theirs. In the end, everyone wants the entire Jewish people to settle in Eretz Yisrael. Everyone wants there to be a Jewish state and a Jewish army. Everyone wants the state to be holy, and everyone wants the nation that dwells in Zion to be holy. The difference is only over the proper pathway, the proper means to achieve this end, and the proper time to do so. And actually, I skipped number three, but he references this passage in the Talmud. But he says that the ideology of the Satmar Chassidim is not based on hatred of the land of Israel, but just the opposite. They love Eretz Israel so much, they don't want its holiness to be damaged, and is therefore forbidden to return it before its proper time. Now keep in mind, Rav Aviner is the absolute opposite as far as perspective of the modern state of Israel. But what he's saying, and what Rav Lichtenstein said, is that fundamentally, the quote-unquote settler and the Satmar share the same worldview. They believe in the divinity of the Torah, that Jewish law is binding. They accept basically the same process in determining it. Now, so let's look at some of the writings. I'm just going to check the chat. So I wrote, I can understand the position of Satmar, but cannot reconcile with the more extreme, like Neturei Karta, who advocate and join with the actual terrorists and call for the destruction of the state. Right, so there is a distinction between Satmar and Neturei Karta. Even within Neturei Karta, there was a group who went to Iran. I think there are about 4.5 people who live in Muncie, New York. So it's not a large group, but they're very vocal. And I think it's very harmful to Jewish people. I would say that especially when we get to loving all Jews, that's going to be a major question. But if we were to understand the Satmar position, if they're basing it on this passage in the Talmud that says if the oaths are violated, the Jewish people will basically be free reign for the nations of the world, then it is coming from the opposite perspective. And this is what the Satmar Rebbe believed, that it was not only forbidden to establish the state of Israel, but doing so put the Jews in harm's way. So really comes from, you know, whether or not one disagrees, it comes from at least the objective of Liefeld was protecting the Jewish people. And as far as the question, let's say from the Satmar perspective, would they also say that just like we said, we quoted two religious Zionist Gedolim, Torah scholars, who said that, you know, fundamentally they share the same worldview as the anti-Zionists. So what about from the other perspective? So I think we'll see in this passage from his book by Yoel Moshe, who is his magnum opus on why he felt it was forbidden to establish the modern state of Israel. So he says that basically, you know, Zionism in the state of Israel was like the golden calf, which lured people into worshiping it. But he says that, and obviously they were secular people, but he says in source 5, even among the most religious Jews who fought hard against the Zionist destruction of the Torah, heresy and atheism, many still approved of the essence of the Zionist ideal to free ourselves from exile and found the state before the coming of Mashiach. But he says this is because the evil inclination is powerful and blinds people's eyes to this truth. So most people do not think it through, so they become accessories to transgressions in various ways. And he says that in among those who joined, and I think here is referring to in source six to Agudat Yisrael, that generally, certainly before the establishment of the state of Israel, they were, you know, at best ambivalent towards Zionism, but they joined the government of Israel. And so he says that he responds to the claim that that other religious Jews say that by being involved in the government and being involved in the process, they'll be able to positively influence the state. So he says that this is basically, they fall prey. This is something that they're, you know, that's incorrect, but those are their intentions. And in source seven, he says clearly to me that the primary reason why people mistakenly support Zionism is because they have not properly analyzed the halacha of the three oaths, and therefore did not accurately understand the severity of the dreadful prohibition of founding a government before the actual end of exile arrives. So I think what he's saying here is that other religious groups who supported to various extents the state of Israel share the same fundamental beliefs. He says that they were, you know, lured by other considerations. He says he maintained that they were incorrect. But the assumption, I think, is that fundamentally they share the same beliefs. So I think we see in both directions, there's a recognition that among all Torah observant Jews who believe in the divinity of the Torah, that fundamentally they share the same beliefs. That's really the application that they differ. And again, as Rav Lichtenstein said, it's not the difference in application is not trivial. Meaning, it's not. I'm not trying to make light of that. They can be very, very, very significant. The point where, at a basic level, one isn't really reconcilable with the other. But still, fundamentally, they come from the same foundational beliefs, and for the most part, the same halakhic process. I'll just note that, at least in the survey, I didn't get anyone who said they identified as Satmar. I'll just note that I think there's a perception that, you know, maybe they don't view, you know, other, you know, Jews who don't share their ideology as Jewish, or, you know, don't have any regard for them. I'll just say, it's, you know, several years ago, Fred Devine knew a family in the Williamsburg, a section of Brooklyn, New York, which is really the biggest enclave of Satmar Hasidim. And so I went there for a Shabbos, and, you know, I don't look Satmar now. I think back at the time I looked less so. And, you know, it's very clear my friend and I were not part of the community. And I don't think I've ever received more Shabbos meal invitations on the street than anywhere else than I did on the Shabbos in Williamsburg. People would come up, they would say, you know, do you have a meal, do you have a place to eat? You know, maybe it was they thought that, you know, because we looked different, maybe we didn't. But you know, people were very very welcoming, and you know, all around the world, the Satmar Hasidim established what we find in many hospitals. I think here there are in Toronto, there are in Satmar Hasidim. I think it's run by some of the other groups, but the Bikur Holim services that they actually was started by Yoel Teitelbaum's wife, who you know, herself would bring the food on the subway. And it's a major service they provide for everyone. And again, not to minimize the differences, they're certainly significant. And not to minimize that can lead to tension and to some extent even hostility. At the same time, I think it's important to know that, you know, one, at least to understand, you know, where they're coming from, and to understand that I think that they would, I can't speak for every person, but at least from my experience, they would certainly, you know, view other Jews as, you know, as Jews, and presumably other Torah observant Jews as at least sharing the same foundational beliefs. The question was, how do religious Zionists, Rabbanim like Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal, answer the issue of the three oaths? So that's a very, very big topic. But In short, there are a few responses. One, as mentioned, it's not quoted by in any of the real halachic sources, so it could be the category of agadah. The Gemara tells different stories, has ethical teachings, but we don't necessarily learn legal practice from there. It also was a perspective that was presented after the Balfour Declaration, that if the world gives its permission to go and establish a state, so then you're not rebelling against the nations of the world. Another perspective is maybe the nations of the world violated their end of the bargain. So there are definitely many responses. The responses I think are compelling, but at least that's the basic that's the basic premise of the belief. And it happens to be the belief in the that the three oaths actually are binding halakha. It was shared by others, including Samson Raphael Hirsch, who is generally known as being more open to the secular world. He was several decades before really Zionism took off. But he felt that it would also be problematic to establish a state. But there's definitely a lot to discuss there. So now, what about to secular? And in some way, it's more difficult, not because there aren't many ways to say that that the Satmar, the secular, and quote unquote the Satmar, the settler, and overall the Orthodox are connected and part of the same people as the Jews who are not religious. But think with the Satmar to settler, it was pretty clear what it was that unifies. It's the belief in the Torah and the acceptance of Jewish law. So what about to the secular? What is it that connects the Orthodox community and ideology to Jews who certainly don't share those foundational principles? I just wanted to give a disclaimer that the perspective that I'm giving on this comes from in Orthodox belief. And I imagine if someone who is quote unquote secular or even non-Orthodox were to give this class, they may identify different things. But I think this is coming from that perspective. And also just personally, I didn't grow up Orthodox, and I've worked also in pluralistic environments. And I personally interacted with people who don't identify as religious, but have a very strong Jewish identity and have a desire to advance the Jewish people and do things that are beneficial to the Jewish people. And I certainly don't want to downplay that. So the question was, do you differentiate between irreligious Jews and anti-religious Jews? So I think I would. We'll see at the end maybe how we would relate to Jews who are anti-religious or hostile towards religion. But as right now, we're speaking more about Jews who are non-religious. But I think included in that and included in some of the sources we'll see are Jews who, at best, are lukewarm towards religious Judaism, but maybe have some hostility. So there are a couple of, characteristics that unify, say, the Jews who believe in the divinity of the Torah and observe halacha with those who don't. And one thing that links them is their family. Right? We all, and maybe if you're a secular, you don't believe this, but if we're coming from an Orthodox, I'm personally coming from an Orthodox perspective, I believe that the Torah is true, that the events in the Torah are true. And what does the Torah say? The Torah says and we're a little bit short on time, so we won't read everything inside, but Hashem, we just read it a couple of weeks ago, tells Abraham that eventually Sarah, who had been barren for many years, will have a child, and his name will be Yitzchak, will be Isaac, and Hashem will establish his covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for a seed after. So meaning not through Yishmael, but through Yitzchak. And we're descendants of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You know, we share the same, you know, great, great, great grandfather. And, you know, I think this is an important perspective. You don't agree with everyone in your family, but it's something that certainly connects you to them. And actually had a professor at the University of Arizona, a Judaic studies professor, who, very interesting person. He was very pro-Israel, which in academic circles, even in Jewish studies, is not, unfortunately, not so common. He was very pro-Israel, but he expressed on several occasions that it was very clear that he didn't believe in Judaism as a religion. He had some respect for religious Jews, at least as far as that, for their generally, you know, greater knowledge of Judaism and Jewish texts, but it was very clear that he didn't believe in the divinity of the Torah. And one time after I graduated the university, and we were pretty close, I think he liked me, I respected him. So on social media, there was a conversation going on, and he made a comment like, you know, we believe in Israel, but not because of, you know, some myth, or he made a comment that, you know, was a little bit denigrating in religious belief. So I asked him, you feel very strongly about Israel. Why objectively do you think that the Jews have a right and a claim to the land of Israel? And he answered the following. He said, can I give you a completely objective answer? Probably not. But I can't give you a completely objective answer why I feel closer to my family, why I feel a kinship and solidarity with my relatives. But this is the perspective. The rest of the Jewish people are my family. And this is our, you know, common historical, in a land that we lived in, and therefore, you know, he identifies with the rest of the Jewish people and believes that, you know, Israel should be our homeland. And I don't personally agree with that perspective. I agree with the family part, but that I don't agree that that's it. But this way, from his perspective, it was a better answer than I expected. I thought it was compelling. I thought it was very sincere. Another factor that unifies, say, the Orthodox to the secular is a shared historical experience. And that historical experience is both when the Jewish people have thrived and when they've been persecuted. Generally, and if you look at different historical periods, generally, they've been at the same time. That when the Jewish people have thrived or have lived in relative comfort, and all of the Jews have benefited. And certainly, when they've been persecuted, no matter what the religious belief or even status within the community, all Jews have been targeted. And see this when all the Jews were taken out of Egypt. Well, there weren't all of them, but. Nation was taken out of Egypt. And then there's also mentioned the prophecy that Bilaam, that Bilaam had, or the blessings that he gave. He says that in source number 10, he says it's a nation that will dwell alone. So there are a couple of interpretations for that, but fundamentally it means that there will never really be totally immersed or accepted by the rest of the world. They'll always have a unique identity, and they'll always be considered, altogether grouped with that a unique identity. And this is said very powerfully. You find in Megillat Esther that Mordechai is telling Esther that she has to approach the king to so that he'll overturn Haman's decree to wipe out all the Jewish people. A man, woman, and child. And he says to Esther, don't imagine to yourself that you will escape in the king's house or among the Jews. Meaning, Esther, you're the queen. You're living in the royal palace. But don't think when all is said and done, you're going to be spared. If Haman has a decree, the king made a decree to wipe out all of the Jews, it's going to include you. And you know, we saw this in the Holocaust, whether it was the religious Jews who, you know, culturally and ideologically didn't assimilate at all into general culture, or Jews who had achieved, you know, high status in the general community, they were all targeted by the Nazis. They didn't make any distinction. And Joseph E. Soloveitchik expresses this idea, as he calls the covenant of Egypt, and he calls it the covenant of fate. And he says, we're all in source number 12, we're all in the realm of a shared fate that binds together different strata of the nation, does not discriminate between classes and individuals, doesn't discriminate between nobility, common folk, rich and poor. Whenever a Jew in the cave is attacked, the security of the Jews standing in the courtyard of the king is jeopardized. And he really is Mordechai and Esther. And the awareness of shared historical experience lives to leads to the experience of shared suffering. And there should be a feeling of empathy from one Jew to the entire Jewish community. Because at the end of the day, the suffering of one segment of the nation is the lot of the entire community. And actually, this address was given on Yom HaTzmud, Israel Independence Day, and was really about the tension between, you know, secular Zionism and religious and Torah observant Judaism. And another facet of this common identity, based on common experience, is a pride in Jewish identity. And this seems very relevant to the early Zionists or the Israelis, who may not have been religious and may have been somewhat antagonistic towards religion, but nevertheless wanted to benefit the Jewish people and had a great pride in being Jewish. And Avraham Eliyahu Kaplan, Lithuanian rabbi, passed away in 1924. So he gave a eulogy to Herzl. He said that Theodor Herzl didn't teach us Torah, and he was never raised with knowledge of it. But he taught us what we know today, to stand tall and proud before the world and demand our rights to return to our homeland. And that he said what maybe even the religious Jews wouldn't say, Ivri Anochi, that I'm a Jew. This is something that's significant. And now the aspect of unity that binds religious Jews to secular Jews is a spiritual unity. And this is expressed in particular, we'll skip number 14 for the sake of time, but particularly in the writings of Shneur Zalman of Liadi, Tanya. He was the first Rebbe of Chabad Lubavitch. And he says that all Jews, this is a premise really of the book, that all Jews share this godly soul. And which means that all Jews, no matter what their practice is, they all have this hidden love that just needs to be uncovered. There are other factors, other temptations that distract them from this love. But fundamentally, they all share this love of Hashem. And he quotes from the Talmud, this is a person doesn't sin unless the spirit of folly has entered into him. Meaning it's not the true self that sins. It's other things that distract, but the true essence of a person, a true essence of a Jew, is that he has a godly soul and has a love for God. And he continues in number 16. We'll say it outside, but he continues on the same idea, that there is a klipa, that there's the shell that can distract the godly soul and distract the person from, you know, recognizing his godly soul. But the fact that one has this godly soul and this hidden love for God manifests itself in particular in the area of self-sacrifice. And we see that we've seen this throughout history, that that when this divine soul and the hidden love is, you know, finally woken up, so a Jew will give his life to avoid accepting idolatry or even transgressing the Torah. And he says that it's not necessarily out of, reasoning or knowledge that, Jew will suddenly, make that decision to, be killed rather than, bow down to an idol. But it's something that that's a result of this godly soul in the Jew that, in which there is a hidden love for Hashem that sometimes is only revealed when a Jew is in a situation where they have the choice to abandon Judaism. And just one example, I know we're short on time, but there's a very powerful story. I spoke about this on Yom Kippur that took place during the Holocaust in a concentration camp. It involved the Blue Shiva Rebbe, Rav Yisrael Spira. And the story goes that there was this a capo, one of the Jews who had assisted the Nazis. And even before the war, he was very hostile towards religion. But the Blue Shiva Rebbe, it was Yom Kippur. And some of the Hasidim asked the Rebbe if there's some way that they could arrange that they could at least avoid doing forbidden work on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur has the same restrictions as Shabbat. So he said, at the very least, is there a way that we can avoid doing these types of labors that would violate Yom Kippur? So the Blue Shiva Rebbe approached the Shni Weiss, this kapo, and he said, is there any way you can arrange for this? And so he says, and this is the account that the Blue Shiva Rebbe says, that he could see that his coldness was starting to melt a little bit. And he pauses for a second, and the Shni Weiss says, I can't help you tomorrow. I can't help you tonight, but tomorrow I'll see what I can do. And then tomorrow, the next day, comes out. He's the capo. He's commanding them, and he says, "You have to wipe the floor without shine the floor without wax or polish to avoid certain forbidden labors. Clean the windows with dry wax." Rags to avoid squeezing it out. He arranged so that it looked like they were doing work, but he made it in such a way that they would avoid the work violations on Yom Kippur. So then at 12 o'clock, the Nazis came out, and they they were so sadistic. This one day, they had a cart filled with food, bread and soup and meat, something they never offered them any at the time of the year, but they knew it was Yom Kippur. And they commanded all the Jews to eat it, otherwise they'd be shot on the spot. So then the SS officer turned to Shni Weiss and says, "Well, you eat, you set the example." And Shni Weiss answered him, "We Jews don't eat today. Today is Yom Kippur, our most holy day." And they said, this isn't a joke. You have to eat. And then again, he said, "We Jews obey the law of our tradition. Today's Yom Kippur, a day of fasting." And the German took out his revolver from his holster, pointed at Shni Weiss's temple. Shni Weiss remained calm. He stood still at attention, his head high. A shot pierced the room, and Shni Weiss fell. And just in that second, when he was faced with the option of publicly desecrating the Torah, or being killed, in that split second, something overcame him, and he went from someone who was in his whole life anti-religious to being a martyr, dying al kiddush of Hashem. And based on this, the Blue Shiva Rebbe remarked that, "I never really understood the statement in the Talmud that even the transgressors of Israel are full of good deeds, the pomegranate is filled with seeds." So he sees, and this is understandable in light of what we saw from the Tanya, that Shni Weiss had this godly soul, and it only needed this type of event, this type of temptation, for it to be revealed. But it wasn't necessarily because of logic or philosophy. There was just something in him that inspired him to give his life for the sake of Hashem. So now the question, and we're a little bit over time, but it'll conclude very soon, is what about loving all Jews? The majority of the those who responded to the survey said that we should love all Jews. It's true, some disagree, which I think is legitimate. So what's according to this perspective that there is a spiritual connection with all Jews, they share this godly soul and this inner desire to serve Hashem and the love of Hashem. So how does that manifested in practice? So he says that once you remove all of the other considerations that distract from this love of Hashem, fulfilling the desires of the body, you'll see, you can understand once you get past that, how great and how high the soul and spirit of another Jew in their root and their source is, especially when you consider that all souls are matching and that we all have one father. Not only are we physical family from Avraham Avinu, but we're a spiritual family. We're soul brothers, as they say. This is why all Jews are called brothers, right? We're called achim, because they literally, and he means this when he said literally, are brothers at the root of their souls in God's oneness. This is something that connects and unifies all Jewish people. So we're a little bit over time, and there's much to discuss. But I think what emerges from this is a recognition that we shouldn't pretend that we're all the same. We're not all the same, even within Jews who believe the Torah, but certainly in the broader Jewish community. We don't all just share the same views, religiously, politically, and those differences can be significant. And it doesn't mean that we have to accept all ideas and behavior. There are ideas, even maybe shared among by other Torah-observant Jews, that we find objectionable, that we completely disagree with. And as Lichtenstein says, we don't have to minimize that. At the same time, one, like it or not, we all share the same faith. And that's very, very clear, no matter of our level of religious observance or our status. But someone comes after the Jews, we're all in it together. And it's something that's very important and should evoke empathy for other Jews. And also, this last idea we mentioned, that we share, all Jews, no matter how removed they are from Torah observance and practice, share this godly soul, all have this hidden love for Hashem. And based on that recognition, there's really no other option than to have a love of another Jew, to realize how great and how special another Jew is. And based on that, it should be obvious that, of course, there were unified with Jews of all practices and of all beliefs. And hopefully we should have this appreciation that all of the Jews, they're part of our physical and spiritual family, and we should identify with them, empathize with them, and try to understand them, and certainly view ourselves as one family and as one people. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Yasher Koach.
Thank you. I appreciated the explanation of where the Satma coming from. Because I certainly don't identify. I don't agree with it at all, but it was illuminating to find out.
Right. I think it's important to know that it comes from somewhere.
It's pretty sorry source, if you ask me, and it's pretty pathetic. And to say that it's not important to save the Jewish people, because without Israel, there would not have been a refuge for millions of Jewish refugees who had nowhere else to go. So when you think, and the Satmar Rebbe himself was removed from Israel by Zionists, which you probably know that story, right?
Right, with Rudolf Kastner.
So Zionists who got him, and he told followers of his to stay in Europe and not come with him, and they all perished in the Holocaust. So he's not my favorite person in the world. But in any case, it was interesting to know it came from something, even if.
But I think one thing that I think is important when trying to understand any belief that that one doesn't agree with, and again, it doesn't mean you have to that one has to think it's legitimate. But I think sometimes, in the respect that we don't necessarily believe that other people really believe what they believe.
Yeah.
And I think if we, recognize that we assume that if other people believe something, then they really believe it. So if I were to think, what if I really believed, let's say, what Nisat Merebi said, or what if I was Nisat Merebi and I really believed that? So would my perspective be different? Then arguably not.
Well, so it's a very destructive force for the unification and Ahavas Yisrael. But I do appreciate the fact that you pointed out, because when my father was in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital
in
United States, and they had an incredible Bikur Cholam there. And you just said, well, I don't cover my hair. I wore slacks in the hospital visiting him. They came every Shabbos. They brought us a full meal. We didn't have to worry. They were very supportive. They treated me like I was Jewish. And so we continued to support the Bikur Cholam of Satmar. So as little as I think of them, I am forever grateful.
Right, I think some people don't really know Satmar until they're in the hospital, and
we support them. So every year they get a check from us for that work.
Because they mentioned it actually started out with the Satmar Rebbetzin, Real Tide Bob's wife, and I think in the early days she cooked all the meals at home, brought it on the subway. It's no small thing.
No, it is no small thing, and in a big, gigantic city like New York, having an army of volunteers running to the hospitals with these meals, it's staggering. It's really, really staggering, and it's very impressive. So there is, they do have a love. And so, you have to give them that. And, pointing out the fact that we have something in common with both secular and... But I have a lot of secular family, not all my, I was brought up, as they say, FFB from birth, but a lot of my family went, quote, off the derech of the way that my grandparents were. And, we're family.
Right. There's something that, binds you.
Yeah. But, and the worst thing that my parents did when we were little, because my was not invite any of our secular relatives to bar mitzvahs and to Pesach Seder, certainly because they it would make mean they had to travel on Shabbos, but it's like they didn't exist sometimes.
Right, there's also a complicated issue with if someone's gonna try,
It's a complicated issue, and it's also an issue of there's a big, big problem with, Torah observant Jews not wanting their children to have any contact with secular Jews because of the feeling that they'll be influenced by them, that they'll be mashpia on them. And it was like who was it the other day? Oh, Rabbi Karapkin on Sunday night, when he talked about the fact that his son came to a play group with the Buzz Lightyear shirt. And even though he had been in Allentown and worked on Kirov and, in the trenches helping other Jews, he was not a Jew that they wanted their children to associate with.
And right. So, I think what I said about Rabbi Karapkin, it was interesting. He seemed to, I'm sure someone who, is by nature gives everyone the benefit of the doubt, but I think he was saying, listen, he may not agree, but I think he agreed in principle that, parents or schools maybe can use discretion about who they want their kids to hang out with. So it's, and I think you, it's a hard dance, but I don't think sometimes people are, you know, maybe too afraid to, you know, to convey to their kids, to let their kids understand that, you know, not everyone is the same. And I think the solution is to, you know, to make your home strong. Meaning if one is very clear about what their values are, then, you know, then I think they don't have to be so worried about, you know, the kids encountering that, you know, not everyone, you know, shares those values.
Well, I think the Lubavitch have done an amazing job with
their kids are in Shlichus. They only encounter people who aren't Shomer Shabbos.
And if they manage it, then all the Haredim should learn how to do it. And we shouldn't have whole communities like on certain blocks, of which I won't mention, for Lashon Hara, in the city, where if you move in on one of those blocks and you look like me, you're not really Jewish. And so unfortunately, not everybody has the attitude of Volmovich as far as that is concerned. You know, that if they can encounter Jews who are not as Torah observant, that, you know, that we're not treif. You know, like, I don't know.
And you see where Lubavitch gets this idea from the Tanya. I think they do have that fundamental belief.
Right. Well, I don't want to dominate the conversation.
No, it's great. Well, thank you everyone so much for coming. I can totally stay on.
Ellie, you look like you have something to say. Ellie Rubenstein.
Okay, I'll say something.
Okay.
Speaking of Satmar and Lubavitch, some years ago, I was visited at my office by two brothers from Montreal who are Satmar Hasidim, and they came to Toronto to raise funds for their institutions. So I welcomed them into my office, and they made their pitch, and I told them that I have a problem with Satmar. Oh, what is that? What possible problem could you have? So I told them, I have the feeling that my love for them and for all of the Jews isn't necessarily reciprocated by them. So they told me, oh, no, that's not correct, Mr. Rubenstein. And one of the two tells me, you know, I'll tell you a story to demonstrate what I mean and to show you that you don't have it right. So he told me that he has a friend, obviously a Satmar Chassid in New York, who habitually goes to various hospitals around town and gets a list of the patients in the hospital, tries to figure out from the names who's Jewish without any regard to their affiliation, just, you know, if they're Jewish. And they come with prepared meals on a tray, and they go to the various rooms and knock on the door, introduce themselves, and present people with a Satmar Bikur Cholim meal. So they came to one door, and knocked on the door, came in. There was a gentleman lying in the bed. A bearded gentleman with a big yarmulke on his head. They introduced themselves. Here, we're here from the Satmar Bikur Cholim, and we brought you a kosher meal. We hope you enjoy it. The gentleman of the bed, his face turned red, and in a fit of rage, he yelled at them, Satmar, I'm Chabad, you get out of here. I don't want you any lousy meal from you. And anyway, your Satmar Shchita is no good. Fooey, I would never eat your meat. So he took the tray and cast it down on the floor. The two visitors quietly turned and left the room. They came back half an hour later with another tray and told the patient, that they got specially for him a meal with Lubavitch shechita meat in it. And reportedly, according to them, this Lubavitch Chassid was so overwhelmed by this that he broke out in tears. And so they said, "You see, we love all of our fellow Jews, and we will, even in a situation like that, if we encounter a Lubavitch Chassid, we'll bring him the meat that he can eat." And that proves that we have great Ahavas Yisrael, and we accept and we love all of our fellow Jews. We just don't believe that it's time for the Eden to go and live in Eretz Yisrael with a government of their own. That's my story.
Very good story.
So you see, there's more complexity. Yeah. And also people are people. You know, sometimes a group has a certain identification, but you know, individuals, you know, you meet some special individuals in all groups. Okay, well, thank you so much, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.
My email address is on the sheet. That's ahek@torontotorah.com. If you ever want to email me or reach out or discuss anything, you know, very, very happy to do so. And then hopefully we'll be able to learn again.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Reverend.